Between the toe of the boot of Italy and the island of Sicily is a narrow passageway of water known as the Straits of Messina. Though this constituted by far the shortest route between Rome and Athens, it was also very dangerous for sailors because of Scylla and Charybdis. Scylla was a dangerous rock formation, which according to Greek mythology, was once a beautiful sea nymph who fell in love with the sea god Glaucus. When Scylla scorned him, Glaucus went to the sorceress Circe to get some help. But when she discovered that his love for Scylla was unquenchable, she decided herself, Circe, to turn Scylla into a monster. And this monster was part woman and part fish and had dogs coming out of her waist. She was forced to live in a cave in the Straits of Messina, where she would destroy ships and devour sailors who happened to come too close. According to Homer's Odyssey, Ulysses lost 6 men to Scylla on his way home from the Trojan War. Nearby was Charybdis, a whirlpool, which according to Greek mythology was once Poseidon's daughter. But because of her greed, Zeus struck her with a thunderbolt and cast her into the Straits of Messina, where 3 times a day she would drink a lot of water and then spew it out again. Sailors tried desperately to steer a middle course between the monster rock formation and the vicious whirlpool. The expression, going between Scylla and Charybdis, came to be used whenever a person ran an obstacle course or took a path between two evils. Last week, we saw that in the face of major opposition from the enemies of God's people, Nehemiah's leadership prospered. But can he survive the monster of greed and the whirlpool of power? Twin dangers that have drowned many a Christian leader. As our chapter opens, we find internal strife shutting down the rebuilding of the wall. The first verse of Nehemiah 5 looks strangely similar to the first verse of Acts 6. Let me read them back to back. Nehemiah 5:1. Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. Some were saying, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." Now, Acts 6:1. In those days, when the number of disciples was increasing, the Grecian Jews among them complained against the Hebraic Jews because their widows were being overlooked in the daily distribution of food. In both cases, there developed a class struggle among God's people over basic issues of survival. In both cases, the complaints were largely justified, and the leaders took those complaints very seriously. And in both cases, great wisdom was required to prevent further division and to facilitate healing among the people of God. Here in Nehemiah, the surface problems are overpopulation, famine, debt, and taxes. Sounds pretty relevant today, does it not? Especially in the third world. Jerusalem is overpopulated because the danger of attack from the enemies around forced everyone to stay in Jerusalem day and night and not return to their homes out in the farmland. The overpopulation, in turn, is causing a famine, which is complicated by the fact that the people have to spend all their time working on the wall and they can't tend their crops. The debt is piling up as people mortgage their homes and vineyards and fields in order to buy food. And taxes, mentioned in verse 4, have to be paid to the government even if there is no money to pay them. Most of us here this morning have never been absolutely destitute, but I think we can understand the tension that would develop in a community when some of the fathers didn't know how they were going to feed their children the next meal. If these families had simply fallen on hard times because of an act of God or nature, perhaps a drought or a locust plague, I doubt if they would have rebelled and gone on strike, quit rebuilding the wall. But they are being victimized by some of their wealthier countrymen. The root cause of this problem is the sin of exploitation in the form of exorbitant interest, unfair foreclosures, and slave labor. Verse 7 indicates that the nobles and officials who are lending money to people to feed their families are exacting usury. Usury is a term that means exorbitant interest. In fact, in verse 11, it indicates that that interest is 1% per month or 12% a year. To those of us who lived through the 70s, that may not seem so exorbitant, but it was terribly high by ancient standards. To make provision for the poor, the Lord had established that the rich were to lend to them. You can find this in Deuteronomy 15. But they are not to charge them interest, according to Exodus 22:25. It says, "If you lend money to one of my people among you who is needy, do not be like a moneylender. Charge him no interest." Verse 11 indicates that in addition to charging high interest rates, these people were foreclosing on the fields and vineyards and homes of the poor when they couldn't repay the loans. And worst of all, they were demanding that the children of these families come and work for them in a slave labor situation. Obviously, Nehemiah is facing a crisis here, and at a very inopportune time. But he sees the complainers as people who are hurting, and he treats them as more important than his production schedule. He knows that people who are deeply concerned over personal problems are not going to work to their best. Now, the second stage of our story finds Nehemiah confronting the problems openly. He has just encouraged these people to air their grievances, and now he faces the issue with the rich. His personal reaction to the outcry of the poor and disadvantaged is found in verse 6. He becomes very angry, but wisely he consults with himself before taking action. He becomes angry at the selfishness, the greed, and the insensitivity of these rich nobles. Anger is an emotion that all of us experience, but not all of us handle it wisely. Some people project their anger on those around them and blame them for what they are feeling. Others try to maintain a semblance of control when in public, but let their anger hang out with their family at home. Still others work off their frustration in competitive sports or by becoming workaholics. The majority of us, however, repress our anger and soon forget its cause. But if we haven't dealt with that cause, it will come back to haunt us later. Anger, of course, is not inherently wrong. It becomes sinful when we lose control and harbor resentment. But Nehemiah admits his anger. He doesn't excuse it, ignore it, or repress it. He doesn't project it on others around him. What he does is to consult with myself, as the New American Standard Version reads here. Or as the NIV reads, I pondered these things in my mind. And then he acts. Thus he avoids the temptation of maligning others and the sin of losing control. It's never wise to act hastily when one is angry, even if that anger is appropriate, which it certainly was in this case. Secondly, Nehemiah accuses the guilty and calls them to public repentance and restitution. A good leader is willing to face problem causers rather than allow the problems to infect and destroy the group. But believe me, this is not easy. One of the hardest things in the world is going to someone directly and confronting them with sin in their life. But antagonists don't go away automatically just by ignoring them, or at least not often. Notice, please, that Nehemiah's accusations are based in fact. He has checked out these allegations, and so he says, "You are exacting usury from your own countrymen." And I believe it's very important for any leader to have his facts straight if he is going to confront someone with a problem in their life. Furthermore, since the behavior of the nobles is affecting the whole community, Nehemiah confronts them publicly. He calls a large gathering to deal with them. But he also provides an opportunity for them to respond. As it turns out, they have nothing to say, indicating that they are guilty of the charges. But even if we are relatively sure that someone is wrong, it's very important for a leader to give them an opportunity to explain their behavior. It may be that that will change our perspective. Most importantly, Nehemiah charges the nobles and leaders to repent and to make restitution. I suppose it would have been a temptation to Nehemiah, since they admitted their guilt, to just say, "Well, I accomplished that. That's more than I expected to accomplish. I better let well enough alone." But no, he realizes that people have been sinned against, and if restitution is not made, God's blessing will not be poured out upon the people. In verse 10, he says, "Let the exacting of usury stop. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses, and also the interest that you are charging them." And even after they agree to do so, Nehemiah suggests that they take an oath. He actually requires them to take a public oath that they will fulfill what they have agreed to do. In all this, it is evident that Nehemiah's concern is both for the welfare of his people and for the reputation of his God. His concern for the poor is seen not only in his willingness to confront the rich and to get their property back for them, but also in his personal standards of living, which he describes so well in the text and which we will look at in a few moments. In fact, he tells us that he was busy buying back these slaves that the rich had sold into slavery. But he has an even greater concern for the reputation of God. Notice it in verse 9. "What you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies?" And later in verse 15, after describing the behavior of previous governors and their assistants, Nehemiah says, "Out of reverence for God, I did not act like that." The psalmist and the writer of the book of Proverbs both tell us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. It was the fear of the Lord that kept Joseph from committing adultery with Potiphar's wife. It was the fear of the Lord that caused Moses to renounce the affluence of Egypt for the hardship of the wilderness. It was the fear of the Lord that motivated Paul to give everything he had to share the gospel with the Gentiles. The worldly people of Nehemiah's day could exploit their own people because they did not live in the reverential awe of God. But Nehemiah understood the holiness of God and the fact that the people of God were designed to be a model of love and righteousness to the nations, not a showpiece of greed and manipulation. That enabled him to stand against the trend of the times and to do a great work for God. In the New Testament as well, the church is called upon to love one another, not simply for our own good, not simply because it's nice, but rather to show the world what God is like. Now, thirdly, Nehemiah demonstrates the kind of servant leadership that pleases God, and he demonstrates it in at least seven ways. In the process, we are going to see how he navigated around these twin dangers of greed and power that affect so many who are in leadership. First, he sets an example by lending without interest. Such action obviously costs him money, but he does it because God requires it and because the people cannot afford to pay it. I think the reason that Nehemiah mentions this is not to build up his own ego to those who read this passage, but rather to demonstrate that he was not requiring anything of these nobles that he himself isn't willing to live by. Now, obviously, this passage is not requiring that all interest, that all loaning be without interest, but rather loaning money to the poor in the family of God should be done without interest. Secondly, he refuses the normal perks of his office. He's the governor of Trans-Euphrates right now. And there are a lot of nice things that go along with a governor's office. Sometimes it's okay to take advantage of the privileges of one's position. Sometimes it's not. It has a lot to do with how receiving those perks is going to affect other people. If a Carl Icahn can make money by engineering a leveraged buyout of TWA, more power to him. But if in the process he milks that company and thousands of people lose their jobs, it's not okay. It may be legal, but it is not ethical. Nehemiah wanted to be sure that his actions were both legal and moral in the sight of God. The fact that previous governors had lined their pockets this way was immaterial to him. It was irrelevant to him. His responsibility was to do what is right. Thirdly, he prevents his associates from taking advantage of the people. Sometimes a leader is not crooked, but he gathers people around him who are shady characters. I think most political experts would say that Ronald Reagan was an honorable man when it came to personal integrity in the White House. But literally dozens of cabinet members and key individuals in his administration ended up being indicted for a wide variety of actions of corruption. The same is true of these governors who had preceded Nehemiah. Their assistants did wrong to the people, but Nehemiah takes responsibility for those who work for him and will not allow that to happen. Fourthly, he works side by side with everyone else. Look at verse 16. Instead, I devoted myself to the work on this wall. All my men were assembled there for work. He didn't direct this work from the safety of a bunker. He was out there in the dirt and sweat and danger, encouraging others by his example. And you could not work for Nehemiah unless you were out there working with the people at the same time. He was there to build a wall, not to build an empire. Fifthly, he refuses the temptation to self-aggrandizement. The last phrase of verse 16 reads, "We did not acquire any land." Nehemiah was of such financial means that he could have taken advantage of the economic situation and bought up the property of many of these poor people and then sold it later after the wall was built for a huge profit, but he refused to do so. In this, he reminds me of an industrialist in Dallas, Texas, for whom I worked for 5 years in the late 60s. His name was John E. Mitchell, Jr., and he founded a company that was a real landmark company in the city of Dallas for many decades. During the Great Depression, Mr. Mitchell could have bought up probably half of East Dallas because he was one of those few industrialists who entered the Depression with a great deal of cash on hand. And he could have rented out these buildings to his employees at an enormous profit. But instead, he chose to offer to his employees that he would buy any one of them a house who wanted a house, and they could repay him for that house with no interest and with very small payments taken out of their paychecks. When I went to work there in 1966, there were still a number of employees who had been with him for 35 or 40 years who swore by John Mitchell, Jr. They worked their heads off for him. And the result was that for 50 straight years, right through the Depression, that company made money as almost no other company did. This man believed that workers should be treated appropriately and rightly, even beyond what was legally necessary. Unfortunately, when Mr. Mitchell died in 1971, his relatives who took over the company were much more like the governors who preceded Nehemiah. And within 10 years, that company was broke and had gone out of existence. Nehemiah refused to take advantage and to bring self-aggrandizement to him and his people. Sixthly, Nehemiah demonstrates hospitality par excellence. Furthermore, it says in verse 17, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table, as well as those who came to us from the surrounding nations. Each day, one ox, six choice sheep, and some poultry were prepared for me, and every 10 days, an abundant supply of wine of all kinds. In spite of all this, I never demanded the food allotment to the governor, because the demands were heavy on these people. As we were singing the song Freely, Freely a little earlier in the service, I thought of Nehemiah in this respect. Freely you have received, freely give. This sense of gratitude for what God has given us is the most powerful motivation possible in a believer's life. Did any of you see the story last Sunday night on 60 Minutes about a pediatric surgeon and his wife who had adopted 21 Down syndrome children, most of them, I think, under 8 years of age? It was a remarkable story, almost unbelievable. They had bought the home next to them so that they have enough places for everybody to sleep. Their grocery bill was something like $2,500 a week. The food bill, the shoe bill, everything was just enormous expenses. They had no government aid. They had a few donations, but they paid for virtually everything themselves. Now, this man had a very lucrative practice in medicine, but he could have lived in a million-dollar home and gone to Cancun every other weekend, but he chose not to. I was impressed, and frankly, I was humbled by that kind of a spirit. I don't know what their spiritual state is. They said nothing about their religious faith that I can remember in the story. But I don't know anyone who deserves more to live in the house of heroes that we talked about a week or two ago than that couple. I believe God would be pleased with his people if they would demonstrate more love to one another in that regard. Finally, Nehemiah characteristically closes this account with prayer as he shows his willingness to wait on God for his reward. Remember me with favor, O my God, for all I have done for these people. Seven times in the prayers recorded in the book of Nehemiah, this man asks God to remember him I don't think he's afraid that God will forget that Nehemiah is there. This is instead a call upon God to do what he has promised to do, to fulfill his gracious promise to take care of those who walk with him. The writer of Hebrews puts it this way: God is not unjust. He will not forget your work and the love you have shown him as you have helped his people and continue to help him. He won't forget. He's trustworthy. That's what Nehemiah is praying for. He does not demand anything in this prayer, nor does he ask for anything specifically. He does not bargain with God. He merely calls upon God to honor his promise. God may do so by rewarding him financially and economically. He may not. He may reward him in this life, and he may not. But he calls upon God to do what he has said, and that is to be faithful to those who walk with him. Now, the list of character traits and actions of Nehemiah's that we have looked at in this chapter remind me of something written by Dwight D. Eisenhower after he served as president of our country. He said, in order for a man to be a leader, he must have followers. And to have followers, he must have their confidence. Hence, the supreme quality for a leader is unquestionable integrity. Without it, no real success is possible. No matter whether it is on a section gang, a football field, in an army, or in an office. If a man's associates find him guilty of phoniness, if they find that he lacks forthright integrity, he will fail. His teachings and his actions must square with each other. The first great need, therefore, is integrity. Nehemiah's unquestioned integrity helped him cope with opposition from outside and opposition from inside. It provided him with courage. It undergirded his conduct. It made him single-minded and helped him navigate between the monster of greed and the whirlpool of power. But compare this list of Nehemiah's to what we see in the business world and in the political world today. Our typical politicians, if they aren't millionaires when they get into office, certainly are by the time they get out. The temptations of money and power seem to be almost irresistible. But we don't have to go to the politicians. We can look at the clergy. You see people like Jimmy Baker and Jimmy Swaggart and Robert Tilton. But we don't even have to go to the obvious examples in the media. We can also look at evangelical clergy. I know a Christian leader quite well who has milked his organization for nearly every imaginable personal perk. He justifies it on the basis of how well the organization has done since he became the head of it. But if the people who support that ministry knew how he had worked the angles to obtain his luxury car and his second home and many other perks, they would not give as generously as they do. But he has hidden those things quite well. But perhaps we don't even need to look at the clergy this morning. Could it be that some of us in our jobs have abused our authority to manipulate others and to feather our own nest? Whenever a leader is more interested in himself, his investments, and his personal ventures than he is in the company, his employees and colleagues will soon learn about it. And in the process, their morale will sag. They will lack motivation, and the best laid plans will come apart at the seams. In conclusion, it has been said that Christian service often doesn't pay much, but the retirement benefits are out of this world. The salary for Sunday school teachers and ushers in our church is not high, though we plan to double it when we move into our new building. But the retirement plan Nehemiah was counting on is still in effect. Remember me with favor, O my God, for all I have done for these people. The greatest servants of the Lord have always been vitally involved in the present, but always willing to look to the future for God's reward. Abraham, Hebrews 11 tells us, had his sight set on a city whose builder and maker was God. Moses chose to endure ill treatment with the people of God rather than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of the Messiah greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking a long way ahead to his reward. Nehemiah, too, put more stock in the future blessings of God than he did in the trappings of greed and power. May we, too, learn from his example. Let's pray.